Thank you. The call is now being recorded. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the locking of a domain name subject to UDRP Proceedings Working Group call on Thursday, 13 December. On the call today, we have Laurie Anderson, Hago Dafala, Christine Durain, Alan Greenberg, Volkan Grayman, Juan Manuel Rojas, Matt Schneller, Gabriela Stack, Melody Adji and Michelle Kuhn, who are representing who is on another meeting. We have apologies from David Mayer, Celia Lerman, and Michaela Nealon. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Barry Cobb, and myself, Julia Charvelin. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, and it's Alan Greenberg chairing the meeting today in light of Michaela not being able to join us. Are there any changes in statements of interest that we need to log? Not hearing anyone or seeing any hands, we'll go ahead. The first item on our agenda today was to go over or to identify any problems with the public comment review tool. I will admit I haven't had a chance to go do a thorough review of it. Has everyone else done their homework and there are no changes, or are there any changes, or do we want to defer this to another meeting? Marika.
This is Marika. I haven't seen any comments, but I'm happy as well to give people more time if they want to. It's just that at some point we'll need to include this or post this on our wiki so it can be referenced and linked in the initial report. So if we can set some kind of deadline, I think that would be helpful, at least from my perspective, so we can get it up there and include it.
Well, I feel comfortable saying I'll have my work done by the meeting next week. Do other people want to defer this into the first meeting of the year, or are people willing to commit to doing it for next week? Any thoughts?
This is Christine. I can commit to doing it for next week.
I can commit to trying to do that for next week. Sorry, December is so crazy. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, let's target it for next week. If we have to defer one more time, we will, but let's try to get it out of the way. Marika, if you could send out a note reminding people, perhaps?
Yep, we'll do so.
Okay. All right, having done that item really well, let's go on to the next one. The intent here is to try to address the straw man proposal in light of the various comments that have been made by various people. And barring anything else, Marika, yes?
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to explain that what you see on your screen now on the left-hand side is what I've done. I've listed the comments that were sent by email, those that Christine sent, and I sent a list of comments. And underneath that, you also see the reply from compliance and the suggestion that David made following that on the email list. So I've all collated that into one document, so hopefully to help your review of the straw man. And on the right-hand side, you see the straw man proposal. I know it's not ideal, but from it in Adobe Connect, it's not easy to resize the documents. What I can do is actually move the agenda out of the way and make the screens a little bit better if that works for people. You do have the option as well at the bottom of each pod to increase the font size if that will help you see things better. And maybe just a note as well, because I know in response to Christine's comments, there were some conversations going back and forth, I think, in relation to registrar practices, I think in the case of a settlement, if I'm not mistaken. But I didn't capture them here separately, but I think it's an issue where we might need to come back to when we get to that specific point.
Okay, thank you, Marika. Certainly, you can move the agenda out of the way. I don't know about everyone else. I have a copy of the straw man in a different window that I have large enough, so I don't really need that on the Adobe Connect. Is there anyone who does need it on Adobe Connect? Otherwise, we could just keep the comment, make the comment summary larger. Well,
I think that's a good idea.
Michelle?
Yes, I need a copy of it. Is it possible to print it down so that we can then move it off the screen?
I don't know what you mean.
Can we print the document from this? Or are we getting our own
copy?
You can't print
from Adobe. It was sent an email to members of this list, though.
But okay. All right, fine.
That doesn't
Thanks.
Help you right now. All right. Let's keep it as it is right now. I think, especially if people want to get rid of the comments on the side or shrink or make them less visible, you can move it around. And hopefully everyone will be able to get things large enough. Michelle, your hand is still up. Is that a new one or the old one? Down.
Got that.
All right. How do you want to work this? Marika, do you want to go through them, or should we go to the original requester, you know, in this case, Christine, to talk through the points they made? I think it's probably better if we can do that. Christine, are you willing to talk us through your comments?
Yeah, absolutely. This is Christine. I'm assuming then we're not going to start from the beginning. We're just going to talk about the things I've discussed.
That's correct.
Because I jumped right ahead. I mean, I didn't have a lot of comments up until draft recommendation number 6. So on the second page of the document on the right screen is where recommendation number 6 comes up. And it says, should the complaint not be deemed compliant or fees not received, the UDRP provider informs the registrar as soon as possible that the proceeding has been withdrawn, following which the registrar will allow changes. And my only point here was not that we necessarily need to capture the minutiae of the UDRP in great detail, but that statement is not actually correct. And if you have a registrar who's trying to follow along with the document, they may be very confused. And my suggestion was that we reference the actual process of correcting administrative deficiencies. So if the complaint is not deemed compliant when the provider does the compliance check, the UDRP gives the complainant 5 days, calendar days, to amend the complaint accordingly. And the vast majority of complainants will do that. In some cases where there's a need to translate the document, the complainant will voluntarily withdraw so they have time to translate. But, and I'm not quite sure how WIPO works that, but that's the process we have in place. So my only suggestion for number 6, with draft recommendation 6, was to sort of fill that in case you have a registrar that is following along with the recommendation and maybe isn't actually looking up the UDRP itself. I don't know if I should stop there then and talk about, you know,
we can then
a specific comment.
Certainly, yes, I think we should do them one by one. It's Alan. I have a question. You're talking about what happens if you find it not compliant and tell the complainant that it's not compliant.
Yes.
The draft recommendation says if it's not deemed to be compliant, which I would have assumed is the step at the end of that process. That is, if they haven't responded to you, or if they haven't fixed the problem, then it's deemed to be not compliant. Because the not compliant that you're talking about, where the complainant has 5 days, it's not really deemed to be not compliant at that point. You're sort of, you know, having this dance going on to decide whether it's compliant or not. Is that not the case?
Well, we deem it non-compliant. When it first comes in, we do what's called a deficiency check. And if there are deficiencies, it's deemed non-compliant, and we send a letter to the registrar or the complainant telling them they have 5 calendar days to correct the deficiencies or their case will be deemed withdrawn. And then the complainant from there has 5 days to correct.
Okay, so really the word in Recommendation 6 should be withdrawn then, not assuming the other providers use the same word.
Well, she put withdrawn in there. It says that it actually says the UDRP provider informs the registrar that the proceeding has been withdrawn, which is what happens after the deficiency check process.
Okay, so the current draft recommendation 6 is actually not technically correct. They're implying that deemed compliant and has been withdrawn are the same thing. And there are, in fact, two different steps in the process.
Correct, yes. There's another step in between. It's not that we deem it non-compliant and then, boom, it's deemed withdrawn. It's we deem it non-compliant, and then the complainant gets a chance to try to bring it into compliance. And if they don't do that, then it's deemed withdrawn. And that's my only point. And it seems like splitting hairs, except to a registrar who is maybe not realizing that there's 5 days there and is wondering, well, where are we at with this compliance check? Is it compliant? Is it not compliant? They're supposed to serve the complaint. And so my point is, if we're going to sort of outline for the registrars, here's where you need to do the lock, here's what's going to happen, and then you're going to get a copy of the complaint when it's served to the respondent, it would be helpful, in my opinion, to have this step be the most accurate possible in order to capture that information.
Okay, noted. Marika, you've had your hand up for a while.
Yeah, this is Marika. Basically, just to ask Christine if she maybe can suggest some wording that we can include in this draft recommendation 6 to make sure that it indeed fits with the practice as it actually happens. I mean, I can try to interpret, but it might be better if you can suggest some specific wording, as you know the process the best.
Well, yeah, I can absolutely. I don't know if I could do it like on the fly on the call, but I can certainly send something, or I can think about it for a second and post it in the chat if you don't mind.
Yeah, no rush. I mean, take your time, and if we have something by the next call, it's more that we following this call we can update this based on the comments and discussions here. So again, if people have other points or wording things, it would be really helpful if they can send those to the list, so we can prepare an updated draft of this that we can then go through for the next meeting.
Okay.
We've also had some comments from Matt and David in the chat. Do you want to speak them so we have a comment in the transcript?
Thanks, Alan. It's David speaking. Yes, I have one comment, which I've mentioned in the chat, which is that in addition to dealing with the question of compliance and the receipt of fees, we should also take account of the complaint being withdrawn for any other reason, and there might be a number of circumstances in which that could occur, one of which could be because the complainant settles the dispute with the respondent before any formal commencement of the proceedings and requests the withdrawal of the complaint, or for any other reason, and the rules make provision for this, it becomes unnecessary for the proceedings to continue. So my suggestion at a textual level is that in the current draft recommendation 6, after the words "or fees not be received," we also add in the words "or for any other reason the proceeding is withdrawn," comma. I also have one other comment or a suggestion, which concerns the last bit of this draft recommendation, where it currently says, as soon as possible that the proceeding has been withdrawn, following which the registrar will allow changes of registrant or registrar within 1 business day after receipt of notice of the withdrawal of the proceeding. My query is whether we would want to time that from the point of receipt or from the perhaps rather more objective point of transmission. So my query is whether we want to consider substituting for the words "after receipt of" the words "after transmission of notice of the withdrawal."
It's Alan speaking. My comment on that is, given that business days vary from place to place, 1 business day after transmission, we would have to make it clear then that it's the business day of the receiver.
True.
It gets a bit awkward.
True. It's just that, and I think that's a fair point, Alan, but it's just that the concept of receipt is a...
on email.
Let's say it's a difficult one to measure.
True. But I presume we're talking about email here.
Right. Typically, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have the generic problem that we never quite know for sure it's been received unless the person tells us. You also had a comment at the beginning that WIPO doesn't call it a deemed compliant. You said you used the term the compliant deficiency notice. So
the way that it works is that the complaint is filed, and if the complaint is assessed and it's found to be compliant with the rules, then typically we would proceed to formally commence and to notify the respondent of the proceeding. And if there would be some identified deficiency, with the filed complaint. We would issue what we call a complaint deficiency notice to the complainant, copying the respondent, which then gives the complainant a period of 5 days in which to correct any deficiencies. We would then look at the amended complaint, and if the complaint would be found to be compliant, I suppose we would confirm its compliance with the complaint, with the rules, and then we would proceed to notify. But the document that we, and I'm not sure if I've understood the question correctly, but if I've understood the question correctly, the document that we use to notify the fact of an identified deficiency, we call a complaint deficiency notice.
Yeah, okay, but the draft recommendation does not refer to the name of the document. It says it was deemed to be non-compliant, and you, effectively, you do deem it to be non-compliant. So I don't think that, I don't think the wording is incorrect for you.
Yeah, we would probably say identified rather than deemed, but it's not a strong preference.
Okay. Any other comments on, Matt, did you have something to add? No? Okay. Marika, do you have enough to go on it, or... I guess Christine is going to give you some text, and you'll come back to us if you feel that you need more.
Yeah, this is Marika. I just have a question on the last sentence, on the suggestion that David made. So is the suggestion to change that to the registrar will allow changes of registrant or registrar within one business day after receiving or after receipt of transmission? Or
after
transmission?
My suggestion, which was followed by the comment that Alan made, my suggestion was that we consider changing the language from within one business day after receipt of notice to within one business day after transmission of notice. But as Alan subsequently indicated in his comments, that does, I think, raise a question about how to deal with notices that are transmitted on a non-business day, because if you would transmit a notice on a Saturday, it may very well not be possible for the registrar to act on that within one business day, I suppose, of that transmission. Although you could also read it as not requiring any action until the next working day had commenced.
Well, the situation I was worried about is, if you transmit it at the beginning of Saturday because you work Saturdays, but the registrar doesn't,
mm-hmm.
Your one business day has elapsed by the time the registrar sees the notice on Monday.
Yes, that's right. But
the implication is we're talking about one business day after transmission. It's the business day of the transmitter, presumably. That starts the clock going.
Can I just interrupt? This is
sure.
Christine. I think David, correct me if I'm wrong. I think the concern here, and maybe I missed it when I was looking at a document here, but the concern is that in some cases we get an email from a registrar that says, oh, I just opened your email now, and you sent it 2 weeks ago, and you don't want the registrant to have its domain name locked for 2 weeks because the registrar didn't open the email.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Christine. Receipt's a very subjective concept.
I will. Okay, I have no problem. I do any registrars on this call have a problem if we put one business day after transmission?
This is Lori. We don't have any problem with that.
Okay, let's put that in the draft, and we'll see if there's any flack from it. I guess I'm a little bit concerned about how one defines that. But I'm not part of the process, so if none of the players are worried about it, then I won't be. Let's go on to the second one. Christine, your comment on draft recommendation number 7.
Yeah, thank you. This is Christine with NAFSE. My draft recommendation number 7 only is that possibly we bolster draft recommendation number 7. The draft recommendation number 7 says, as part of its notification to the registrant, the UDRP provider informs the registrant that any corrections to contact information are also required to be communicated to the UDRP provider. Corrections to contact information and who is are allowed, as it otherwise would contradict who is accuracy policy. And my only suggestion there was to actually reference UDRP rules 5.2 and 5.3, where the respondent is required to provide its contact information to the provider. And that is because, this document is going to be an awesome document when we're all done with it and have some great recommendations. But I think in places where we can actually reference the actual policy and rules of the UDRP, the actual sort of consensus policy that we've all been following for a dozen or more years here, I think it'll just bolster it a little bit more. And that's my only suggestion. It wasn't even designed to be sort of controversial or anything.
Yeah, I think I support that. Having currently being in the middle of the process where the recommendations of a PDP are being translated into text for the formal policy, the more we can do to make sure that those who draft the final text cannot misunderstand what we're talking about, the better. So I support that concept. I don't see any hands up. I don't think we need to debate it. Number 8.
Okay, number 8 says this notification would also include this, and I think the notification here, I'm just going to look up really quick, the notification of respondent, notification to respondent, so this is when we actually commence the case. So this notification would also include information that any changes as a result of lifting of proxy and privacy services would need to be discussed / addressed by the UDRP directly. And then we talk about our recommendation that the issue is further reviewed. But I believe the language here is very vague, and this is no offense meant to Marika, because I think we've had a lot of very contentious, or not even contentious, but a lot of varying discussion around this issue. But any changes as a result of lifting proxy or privacy services doesn't specify whether such would be allowed or disallowed or frowned upon or preferred. And then it says would need to be discussed or addressed by the UDRP panel directly. And again, the issue at the moment at which proxy and privacy services become a problem is at the moment when we're doing that compliance check, we're trying to actually determine who the complainant and the respondent in the case are and getting those named properly in the complaint and then getting the proper parties served. Once that happens, as I've pointed out before, there sort of isn't a lot of need. I mean, if you lifted a proxy service halfway through the response period and you guys noted, you know, and a respondent notified us, we would, you know, send a courtesy copy, but we wouldn't start the time over or anything. And so really, there's the only thing the panel is going to decide at the end of the day is, you know, do they want to change the caption of the decision, you know, different from the way provider listed it? Do they want to toss out some domain names as maybe being registered to another entity? But that doesn't really address the initial problem of proxy and privacy services. And we may decide at the end of the day that there's nothing we can do about that, but I just want to make sure that we've thought about it, that this doesn't address the issue. This doesn't say whether or not we can lift proxy or privacy services, how it should be done, and where the lock happens in the process. And if you're going to lift a proxy service, do you have to do it within one business day or two? And so that's sort of my question. This is my sort of my most, you know, I guess, contentious point as far as, like, having a discussion as far as how, you know, what we think about this particular recommendation. Anyone?
Listening to you, I can only agree that we need more clarity. I'm not quite sure I know. I know what the right wording should be. Matt has his hand up. Let's go to Matt. That sounds like an easy way out for me.
Um, I, just wanted to agree with Christine's point that the key is really to make sure that if this happens, it has to happen within that period prior to the, within that one business day before the lock is instituted for it to be useful. I guess it may also be worth clarifying that the Privacy or Proxy Service should only be able to substitute the data they have in their system, in their records, as the ownership agreement, or as the owner of the domain name, at the time they get the request from, whether it comes from the registrar or from the provider, prior to institution of the lock. Otherwise, they'll have a big gaping hole where, you know, a less scrupulous privacy or proxy service, instead of just substituting out the information they have in their file, can simply send an email to their client and say, hey, you got a UDRP filed against you. Why don't you change your name to something different now? Like, there's nothing... I'm not saying to make privacy...
You're saying we should try to avoid a virtual transfer done at the level of the privacy service.
Right. Well, or at least say that... At least include something that would limit the ability of that to happen. Otherwise, we're going to have a pretty big loophole where privacy and proxy users are going to have more ability, just because they're using the privacy and proxy service, to change their information in a way that's equivalent to the sort of cyber flight problem that we have now, that a user that doesn't have a privacy or proxy service won't have.
I'm not sure we have any way to enforce that, but we certainly should say it, in my mind.
Yeah, no, I think we have it, and you know, if we say it and we say that you can't do it or include some sort of limitation, at least it's there, and if a party is not doing what they're supposed to, at least there's something for compliance to deal with. But if we don't have any restriction, there's no reason I can't do it.
Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I think the issue there is, and as you already said, we currently don't have contracts or agreements with privacy and proxy services, so we would have no way to enforce that, even if we would put it here in the recommendations. I agree. I think it's important to clarify whether the lifting can happen within that one business day, and maybe the place to clarify that would be recommendation 3, where I think we talk about, you know, the one business day and what changes need to be prevented, and maybe there is where we want to clarify then that, you know, within that one business day, there can be a lifting of a privacy proxy or not, depending on what the group decides. But I think this is probably then an issue that we want to specifically reference forward to the effort that's going to look at accreditation of privacy and proxy service, to make sure that it's taken into account there, that indeed those rules then should include that the privacy proxy service cannot inform, or, you know, however we want to word it. But I think it's I just want to make sure that, you know, it's clear that just because we put it in here doesn't necessarily mean that we can enforce it if there's no contract in place with the parties we're trying to enforce something on.
No, Marika, I agree with you. We can't enforce it, but without the words here, it's not clear it's part of the UDRP. So since we can't synchronize the two processes exactly, we better put it in here, and they will then have to follow suit, because the contracts that they may end up with, the people talking about privacy proxy services, need to agree with all the policies in place. So we need to put it in place here, obviously without an ability to enforce, but nevertheless make sure it's part of the process. Otherwise, as was implied, the concept of saying you can't change who owns the domain name is rather farcical. It is a chicken a cart and horse issue, but I think we need to put it in here. No disagreement. No agreement either. On the other hand, I'm assuming the rest of you are still on the line. I have a question before we go on to the next one, and it was mentioned briefly, and I'm not quite sure if it's in this recommendation, but we've talked a lot about whether WHOIS needs to change when the proxy privacy's when privacy is lifted. And the comment has been made that once the provider is notified, it doesn't really matter if WHOIS changes or not. Is it within our scope to say that WHOIS need not change? Or should we be completely silent on it, which is what we are right now? My inclination is to explicitly say that it need not change. I'm not sure I want to say it must not change.
Yeah, Ellen, this is Christine. I think that there's a variety of practices between registrars. Some, even if there's a proxy service change or whatever, they will release the privacy shield to in the WHOIS. The WHOIS information will change at that moment. Like, for instance, GoDaddy does it, you know, pretty much instantaneously. Some registrars tell us who the underlying registrant is but don't release it in the public WHOIS data. And I think I'm answering your question when I say I don't know that either one is per se wrong. I mean, because as the way the NAF does it, maybe David can weigh in if he wants to, but the way we do it is if we get different data from the registrants and the WHOIS, we just serve both. But you're correct. At the moment we serve everybody, we're done looking at the WHOIS. We're not going to go back and check and see if something changes and send a new notice out or do anything like that. So if whatever happens in that one business day happens, we're content to serve all the addresses that we have on hand and all the email addresses and everybody, and that's fine. But after that moment, you're right. As well, you know, you can change it or not. We kind of don't care.
Yeah, I guess I from a registrant point of view, I object to I have a problem with WHOIS changing when it hasn't been demonstrated that the registrant has done anything wrong yet. And I understand there's currently a problem with the fact that you're obliged to report after the fact who the registrant was you were dealing with. But I, you know, maybe that needs to be fixed one day. But I have a problem if registrars feel that they must change the WHOIS to reflect who the owner is or who the beneficial owner is.
Right. Yeah. I would be supportive of allowing the registrars to continue their practice, whichever the case may be, because they've got their own agreements with their customers. You know, some of them say, we're going to reveal it, so if you do something wrong, look out. And some say, we're not going to reveal it. And that's, I don't have a problem with that, as long as it's, if you're going to reveal it, you're doing it within the time period that we prescribe or, you know, recommend.
Okay. Marika and then Volker.
Yeah, this is Marika. I have a different point, so maybe let Volker go first if this is in relation to the conversation you're having.
Okay. Volker? Can't hear you. Me, you might be muted.
I was muted, sorry. Yes, indeed. As a registrar, we do not want to unblock the WHOIS privacy service, i.e. show the world who the registrant of the WHOIS privacy service is, because he might not have done anything wrong. On the other hand, it is something that we feel that we're forced to do in case we receive a UDAP decision, because there's no guarantee that if we only privately inform the complainant and the provider about the underlying registrant, that the complaint will be amended, and in the end, we do not want any complaints, i.e., UDAP decisions against our privacy providers. We do not want to see those privacy providers as seen as bad actors, and therefore we reveal by removing the privacy function, which is not something that we want to do and that we feel very uncomfortable doing, but something that we feel that we're forced to.
I'll note that even if the request is found for the registrant, they are still revealed in the final report that's published by the provider under the current rules.
Exactly.
So for all you have to do to find out who owns a domain is file a frivolous UDRP. In other words, anyone with money can undo a privacy service. But I tend to agree with you that it would be better if if it wasn't changed in who is, in a, which is a much more public, you know, public and long-living document. Can we hear from the providers? This is the first I've heard from the comment that Volker just made that they're worried that if they don't change who is, the provider might not have gotten the information and the privacy service may be held liable. That sounds like a communication problem.
Yeah, I would ask Volker, this is Christine, had that situation happen? I mean, not that we're perfect and infallible. I mean, certainly I'm sure we've made a mistake, but our practice personally here is that when we receive the verification from the registrar, we serve that information and we serve the information in the privacy in the WHOIS. Our case caption will name whoever's in the WHOIS. So if the privacy service remains in the WHOIS, that's what the caption of the case will say. So we will serve every single address, email address, and fax number that the registrar emails us. And that's part of our standard process. Again, I mean, we may have made a mistake at some point, but I would wonder if that's just a generic concern or if you've actually seen this happen and you're concerned about preventing a recurrence. Because I would be very concerned, and I would want to hear if someone reported that happened. I would personally want a phone call if someone thought that happened.
Well, I've seen a case personally where we had not uncovered the WHOIS because of... Hello?
Sorry, can you try that again? You were masked.
Yes. I've personally seen a case where we had not immediately revealed the registrant by uncovering the WHOIS, by removing the privacy function. And in that case, the complainant declined to amend the complaint while the provider has continued providing the complaint and forwarding everything to the address we provided for the underlying registrant. It still had our privacy function, our privacy provider, as the respondent of the case in the headline. And
yes, and that's our practice. Whatever's in the public WHOIS will also be published in the caption of the decision, unless the panel wants to change it. The panel that's where we kind of talked for a minute ago in proposal 7, I think, about that. If the panel wants to change it, or maybe this is still at number 8, if the panel wants to change it to the underlying registrant, they certainly can. But if the privacy service remains in the public WHOIS, then that's who is going to be publicly listed in the decision as well. And that's our internal practice. But we have served and notified everybody that you would have emailed to us.
Okay,
yes.
Christine, let me ask, it's Alan, let me ask a question. If the WHOIS is changed, do you still list the privacy service who were there originally?
If the WHOIS is changed at the time of the lock, you know, so we get the verification email back from the registrar that says, here's the underlying registrant, and by the way, the WHOIS has changed, we go and look again. If the WHOIS has changed, then the whoever was listed originally in the WHOIS, whether that was a privacy service or whatever, that person disappears from the complaint altogether.
Unless for some reason
the complainant makes some sort of an argument in its complaint that they think it should go against the privacy service, and then it'll be up to the panel to buy that argument or not. But our policy in that case would be to name the case after the actual registrant, and it would be the panel would trump that if they chose to later on when they got the case.
Okay. So that's a strong reason why a registrar or their privacy service may want the WHOIS changed.
Correct.
Okay, we have a long list of speakers. Marika first.
Yeah, this is Marika. My question is more trying to get clarification on what we want to put into draft recommendation number 3, but I think Matt made a very valid point in the chat saying that, you know, the listing and, you know, whether it changes WHOIS or not, that's something, you know, between the privacy and proxy servers and the registrants. So
okay.
Maybe it's something that we don't need to say anything about, and we can just, but we would need to clarify in recommendation 3, I think, whether indeed within that business, one business day before the lock is actually applied,
whether that listing is still allowed as, you know, currently happens, and possibly clarify that. And we could there then say, I guess, something like, you know, as per the agreement between the privacy protection service and the registrant, or, and just leave it at that. That might be one option.
Okay. Matt?
Just actually a question for you, Alan. If the concern is that a party could file UDRP that was not a winner but was valid enough to get by an initial compliance check for deficiencies, you know, that very basic initial check that the provider does to make sure that there's an actual claim under the elements of the UDRP, that person's going to get, even if the public who is information isn't changed, the complainant would still get access to the domain name owner's information, even if public who is wasn't changed. So I don't know that.
Yeah, no, we're not going to fix that problem by this. I think that's somewhat out of the scope of a locking PDP. I was just, you know, wondering if we could ameliorate it or make it less public.
Oh, got it. Okay.
But I think we're getting too deep into a swamp if we go there.
Okay. Question.
Anyone else on this issue? Marika, are you comfortable where you're going with this for the next draft, or do you want to talk more?
Yes, I'm happy to write something up, but again, you know, if people are not happy with what I write, please feel free to suggest, you know, edits or ways to write it differently, because, you know, I'm not a lawyer here, and I'm just trying my best to capture what is being discussed here.
Okay. Christine, you're back up.
Okay, my suggestions with respect to draft recommendation number 9, the recommendation says, upon receipt of a decision from the panel, the registrar must, and then there's a question, within 2 business days, communicate to each party, the provider, and ICANN the date for the implementation of the decision in accordance with the policy. And then there's a highlighted section that says, further consideration may need to be given to the current discrepancy between 10 and 15 days, waiting days, depending on whether the complainant or respondent prevails. So I just attempted to provide a little clarity there, which is that the communication of the decision date under UDRP Rule 16 says 3 calendar days. So I was just providing a little clarification there. And then I was attempting to explain what I believe is a lack of discrepancy between the 10 and 15 days between points 2 and 3. And I am not sure if anyone wants to disagree with any of that, but my point was just UDRP paragraph 4K just says that the registrar is going to hold off on giving a prevailing complainant the domain name for 10 business days to allow the – basically it's to allow the respondent or the registrant to file a lawsuit. And the transfer in that case was done by the registrar at the order of the panel, and pursuant to – I want to say UDRP paragraph 3, but I don't have the rule right in front of me. And then the UDRP paragraph 8 is specifically directed to the registrant. You shall not transfer the domain name away and that sort of thing. And so by keeping the lock for that additional 15 days, it's just the registrar enforcing U paragraph 8, which says to the registrar or the registrant, you may not transfer the domain name subsequent to a decision, even if you prevail. My only thought there is that, you know, the only limitation there is not transferring it away to a new registrar or registrant. So our best practices document may wish to suggest that the registrar, especially a registrar we've talked about who may have moved the domain name into a holding account or otherwise made the domain name inaccessible to the respondent, so their registrant, you know, if the registrant prevails, the only thing that has to happen is the domain name can't transfer to a new registrar for 15 days. It doesn't say that the registrant can't have its domain name back in those 15 days. So my suggestion is if we're going to allow people to kind of have these varying modes of locking, that they, you know, be very aware that they shouldn't be depriving their client of their rights during those 15 days, any other than their right to transfer.
Okay, so when we define lock or freeze or whatever we call it, we may need a different one for this period.
Yeah, or just further clarification. This whole process is a little, this whole point of draft recommendation number 9 is very muddled. I would say that draft recommendation number 9 is the least understood by registrars and even complainants and to some degree. So I think that, and registrants for sure. So I think that the most clarification we can provide, you know, specifically regarding how this pertains to the lock, obviously, because that's our scope, I think that's going to be very helpful to people, especially people who are trying really hard to follow the rules but just don't know what they are.
Okay. Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. If I maybe can ask Christine again to maybe suggest some language here, because I agree. I struggle with this one, and it's an issue where we haven't really discussed in great detail. I think there's an issue that was raised in the early discussions we had in the working group that there is this discrepancy, and I said, I'm not even sure how it works, so I think it would be really helpful if, you know, as you explained it to us now, if that is something you would be able to put in writing as well, so we can actually include it here and really have it clear for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll put my suggestions for both down, and then I'll send them around the same way I sent my other comments. And then if people want to weigh in, sort of like they did before, maybe we can even accomplish some business before we meet next week.
It dawns on me as we're having this discussion that we may want, as one of the outcomes of this, a table showing, you know, going down the left side, the various stages of the UDRP process, and then columns for various items in who is that need to be locked or you know, where changes are allowed or not allowed during that time period.
That's a very fascinating point.
I think that may bring some clarity both to the final people involved using it and to us to help define the lock freeze periods. Because as you think about it, it gets more and more complex. You know, the technical contact, for instance, you know, there's probably no reason that can't change at various points along the way, just as we say the phone number or email address of someone, if it changes, we want to keep that up to date. That's a requirement of keeping who is current. So I think we may actually want some detailed clarity for us to understand it, and perhaps it'll be useful as a follow-on process. Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. I think that would definitely be the idea. I mean, at least that's what I had in my mind. Once we indeed have these recommendations, and possibly wouldn't be something, you know, we can accomplish by the initial report, but similar to what we did, for example, I think with in one of the other PDP working groups, where we basically made one of the recommendations that as part of the implementation, a detailed flowchart would be developed that would really make it clear, and, you know, someone not like me putting some arrows on some boxes, but actually, you know, the kind of professional graphic artist that really would put that all in a kind of flowchart, so it really would become clear and match indeed the recommendation. So I think that is definitely the intent behind, you know, the flowchart that I have here, the very basic one, and going through these recommendations, that what we have at the end of the day can be translated again into a kind of flowchart or table or whatever works best to really make sure that it's clear what needs to be done at every step of the way.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I guess I was suggesting something earlier, that is, as a working document for us to, you know, have along one axis the stages, and along every axis, as I'm listening and talking about it, I suspect we probably want every element of the who is to make it really clear what is allowed to change, what is not allowed to change. You know, that would then be, you know, summarized or processed into a form that we're proud to distribute to the public. But as a working tool, it may be useful.
Well, the beauty of a table is that it does, you know, this is the former teacher in me coming out, but it helps other learners, you know, other people who see walls of text or pages of text and, you know, panic. You know, I can't read all this, I can't digest it, I can't understand it, but I think a table is nice because it allows you know, people to look at it and feel like they can understand the information presented better.
Yeah, it's Alan speaking. I tend to agree. And, you know, when we came into this, I, who was not at all familiar with UDRP, presumed that when we said lock who is, we we meant nothing can change in who is. And what we have today is a very different picture. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who is naive. David.
Thanks, Alan. Just a comment and a suggestion, one of which I'm about to drop into the, just have dropped into the chat box. And the first is just with respect to draft recommendation number 7, in which we're speaking about this idea of introducing into the notification process the UDRP provider informing the respondent that any corrections to the contact information are also required to be communicated to the UDRP provider. And I just wonder if, as a prelude to that, we would also want to identify a recommendation that there be such requirement on the registrants. Because I'm not sure at the moment there is, and having the provider inform the registrants that there is such a requirement without first bringing it into existence might not actually solve the problem that we're trying to address here, which is that if there is a change in contact information and the registrant makes that change or requests that it be made to the WHOIS, that they should, as a result, be obliged to, you know, let the provider know about that.
They being the registrant or they being the registrar?
They being the, well, either, I suppose. It's the entity that makes the change.
Well, the registrar is the vehicle. They may not have originated the change, or they may have.
Well, that's right. But I suppose if there's no change that results for the purposes of the UDRP proceeding, and I'm talking here only from a provider perspective, but it doesn't really matter too much. If there is some sort of change in contact information, you want to know about it if possible, so that you can make adjustments for purposes of notifying the proceeding. But from the provider's perspective, you simply need to hear about it either from the registrant that's requesting the changes or the registrar if the change is being made. It doesn't matter too much who it is that provides the information. I just note that there is a provision in the UDRP rules that exists currently under paragraph 2E that says that either party may update its contact details by notifying the provider and the registrar. So this implicitly permits, I suppose, such modifications to contact information and right. Stipulates the way for that to be done by duly notifying the provider.
Right, and David, rule 5, 2, and 3 also says the respondent needs to tell the provider their most current and correct contact information. So I think there's a lot of basis for that.
Okay, Marika?
Right.
Yeah, this is Marika. My question actually was in relation, because I saw that, you know, Christine indeed already clarified that it is a requirement. So I think I'm basically missing something, because what is not required, David, that you want to see required as part of your suggestion? Or you just want to clarify that is a requirement, that they need to
provide exactly.
Informed?
Yes, exactly. To clarify also the basis for the requirement.
Okay, yeah, and I think Christine suggested similarly to reference the rule, so I can definitely look at that and make that more specific.
The other comment that I have, this is David again, is just to note that we make a comment in parentheticals in the draft recommendation 7 where we state in those parentheticals that corrections to contact information in WHOIS are allowed, as it would otherwise contract WHOIS accuracy policy. And I just wonder if we need to make such a definitive statement for purposes of this recommendation. It seems to me that the illustrative purpose of including the comment would be equally well served by simply noting that it may contradict WHOIS accuracy policy.
Yeah, Marika, if I can answer. I know in other in other PDPs, we've included with each recommendation or with some recommendations a rationale for why we made it. And, you know, it's not part of the recommendation, but it explains to someone who may not be up on the details exactly why it was done or who, you know, hasn't been part of these discussions. So if that kind of parenthetical comment is needed, I think it would belong in a rationale, not in the recommendation itself. And by the way, Marika, you're missing the closing bracket on that.
Right. And I agree with the general principle of including some form of rationale, maybe by moving it to a slightly different point. But my general comment would still stand, which is that I'm not sure that we necessarily need to take so firm a view, even in an expressed rationale, that changes to contact information would in all cases contradict WHO's accuracy policy. I mean, I think the purpose of the rationale is equally well served by noting that it may.
Okay, thank you. Marika, you have your hand up, and I note we have a minute left, and we need to talk about when the next meeting is. Was that what your hand was up, or are you on substance?
Both. On the point that David made, I agree, and I think it's maybe something we can, because as I'm building the initial report, I'm trying to explain for each of the charter questions, the working group discussions, and that includes as well party rationale. So I think it would make sense to move that there, and I don't think it makes too much difference to say would or may, so I can definitely change that and take that out. And then indeed to note on the next meeting, based on the doodle poll that will be scheduled for next Wednesday, 19th of December, for 1400 UTC.
And thank you, Marika. David, is that a hand that still needs to be up?
That's a vestigial hand.
A vestigial hand. An expression which was only invented a week or two ago, but it's finding common usage. We didn't go nearly as far as I thought we were going to today, but we've had some really productive discussion, I think. So we'll meet again next Wednesday and continue from here, and I think Michele will be in the chair seat. But regardless, have a good week, all. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Alan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.